Hi, I'm Mike Williams.
Senior Focus. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Anne-Marie Khoury. I'm your presenter for this edition of Senior Focus. And I have with me today John Watson, the councillor for Albany. And John is a chair of one of the biggest, most influential committees of the council, which is the Transport and Infrastructure Committee, which is a committee of the whole. In other words, it comprises all councillors on the council. So, John, welcome to this session.
Thanks, Anne-Marie. Thanks for having me.
And in particular, I offer congratulations on the success of your campaign to save the North Harbour Stadium. And I raised that right at the outset because I want you to talk about what's happening now. It isn't actually safe yet entirely, I don't think, and I would like to hear what your view of the situation is now.
Yes, yeah, no, that's been a remarkable one for your listeners. North Harbour Stadium is this beautiful stadium in Albany, Auckland's newest stadium, in fact. It's only about 25 years old. And very recently, there was a plan by Tātaki Auckland Unlimited, which is a Auckland Council CCO, basically to demolish the stadium and to sell off the land. Now, that was revised in the public consultation that went out earlier in the year, but basically for a couple of years they'd been working beavering away with consultants and whatnot on a plan of how they could sell off the land there, which is a sporting precinct which has, you know, a whole number of community fields and the main ground and outer oval. Since 2014 it was handed over to Auckland Council. Before that, it was actually run by North Harbour Stadium Trust and was very successful, had all manner of big sporting events, All Black Test, rugby league, soccer franchise there, concerts, you name it, it was there, and was really, you know, the focus point for the whole region north of the bridge. Since going over to the council CCO, this mouthful, Tātaki Auckland Unlimited, which doesn't really mean very much to people, but it is a CCO, that content has gradually and then quite dramatically declined to the point where the stadium hasn't been getting used at all well, despite the fact that, you know, the population's going through the roof in this area. So that was their solution, was to demolish it, which was just anathema to the people north of the bridge, who in many cases who have very fond memories of going there over the years and who had to work very hard to get that stadium. So it took quite a massive campaign to hold back that kind of move. Fortunately, in the council meeting just a couple of months back, the vote was taken to investigate an alternative management or operational management there, i.e. just to get some new entity in to run it and to try and get it back to what it was like before, which is what it should be. So that's happened, and there's a bit of an investigation underway with the local boards from the Albany ward leading that at the moment to see what new kind of trust or management entity could be formed just to run it better and to start getting sports and entertainment and things there. Auckland's a big place and we need all our stadiums. The population is double now what it was, you know, when the stadiums were first built, so they should be getting utilised to the max. There's been a lot of money invested in them, and they're more so now than ever. They're central to the, you know, to the well-being of big chunks of the Auckland region.
Yes, thank you for that overview, because not everybody lives on the North Shore who participates in listening to the program. So I'm sure it's very useful we do know that 40% of people living in Auckland have been here less than 8 years. And so I'm always aware that our listeners need the backstory. Another story that you told recently to a Grey Power meeting was the story about the value of the consultation to Auckland over the recent months that saw the result for the ports of Auckland make sure that that wasn't another casualty of assets being sold or leased. And I wonder if you'd like to talk about this, because it seems that people did wake up rather late in the piece to the idea that maybe goods and services that were coming in through the port would actually rise in value quite sharply if the port wasn't under local control.
Yes, well, since the Super City was set up, but certainly within, you know, the last 5 or 6 years, there's been quite a concerted program of asset sales, normal sales of council land and facilities that would, run into hundreds of millions of dollars. But over and above that, there has been sales of, or attempted sales of, some of our biggest and last remaining assets, a number of which have been income producing. So assets like the airport shares, like the diversified assets portfolio, and like the ports of Auckland. And in this last consultation that just went out, this year, there was a proposal basically to lease out the ports of Auckland to some entity, most likely a foreign one, for the next 35 years. That was, fortunately, that was dropped at the last minute, actually, despite the fact that people did, feedback on it. And that would have been entirely retrograde step, where essentially Auckland, it was essentially a generational sale of the ports of Auckland. And that was a starter. I mean, there may well have been a renewal of any lease or the option to do that. So that was really quite a dangerous move, in my view, where the ports of Auckland facilitate business. They facilitate the flow of, goods and services across Auckland, and they keep that cost, down to a minimum, while it's still at the same time still returning a dividend to Auckland Council, Auckland ratepayers. Any entity coming in to take up a lease, of course, would be obliged to make a profit for their shareholders. So straight away, they would be looking to increase costs. So that was a move driven largely by the mayor, but which he withdrew before the actual vote. That didn't happen with the airport shares, which was another income-producing asset, which grew in shareholder returns to Aucklanders about $2.5 billion in an 8-year period between 2011 and 2019, basically, made up of dividends and capital growth. Last year, 7%, Auckland owned 18.5% of the shareholding at Auckland International Airport. Last year, nearly just under half of them were sold, $835 million worth, to pay down debt. This year, basically, the balance was up for grabs. Only in this instance, it goes into the so-called Auckland Future Fund. We are told to get a better rate of return, but at any rate, the intention is to sell them. So they were shares that Auckland City Council and Manukau City Council held onto, and regularly return dividends anywhere $40 to $60 million a year to Auckland Council.
Yes, and with the situation with the airport shares, I heard you say at this Greypower meeting about the process for preparing for sale, the advice, the kind of advice that was given and the kind of people, the consultants who were employed by the council to give this advice. And you made some quite salient comments. And I would like you to make them again, because I understand that it was through examining all this process that you were led to the action of writing to the Auditor General about aspects of the process.
Yes. Last year, when the first tranche of airport shares were sold, and you know, nearly half of them, an Australian company of consultants called Flagstaff Group, they were employed by the council to give advice rather late on in the piece for both the sale of the airport shares and also for advice on the options for the ports of Auckland, which were largely concentrated around leasing out operations for some period of time. Now, when Councillor Mike Lee and myself looked at this a little closer, we found a few aspects of their engagement that were a little concerning, to say the least. The first was the sheer quantum of the money they were paid. So for that advice, they were paid out over $3.5 million, roughly $2 million for the Port of Auckland potential lease, which, of course, as I said before, amounted to nothing, and another $1.5 million for the airport shares in a pretty short space of time, I might add. But included in that was this rather unusual payment of $1.425 million that would be conditional on any decision to sell the airport shares in part or in whole. And that was, you know, that agreement was struck with Flagstaff prior to the vote on in the council, and you know, in fact, and prior to the advice being given out. And in our view, that amounted to little more than a de facto incentive payment to get a decision to sell across the line. Obviously, if you're giving advice on something and there's a big payment conditional on that advice going a particular way, and you know, prefaced perhaps by additional work related to a particular decision, as was the case here, then that's not the best position to be in. There's an incentive to get a sale across the line. So we have written to the Auditor General to clarify that matter, whether in that his view, having such a clause in there where basically dependent on a sale, and they're meant to, you know, they're the party giving the advice, that in most people's eyes would amount to a bit of a conflict of interest. Additional to that was the fact that when we looked a bit closer and asked for more information, we found that, you know, over and above the $3.5 million, there was $135,000 worth of payments for out-of-pocket expenses, as they were described. And we really wanted to find out, well, when you're getting paid millions anyway, what on earth is this other $135,000 worth of, you know, where's that coming from? What's it going to? And when we tried to find out, we couldn't actually get receipts or invoices to say, well, it was spent on this or it was spent on that. It covered accommodation and airfares and travelling around and a few other generic descriptors. But at the end of it, we were none the wiser really as to who, how many of them had spent what on what activity. And we found that to be totally unacceptable. Was almost a matter of them producing their expenses and the council just paying out that, and for us that seemed to be in breach of the Auditor General's advice on sensitive expenditure, you know, and it certainly is sensitive, that kind of spend. So for a relatively limited number of people to run up that extent of expenses with, you know, limited number of trips over to New Zealand, that was a concern to us, just as was the fact that there didn't appear to be any receipting of what this money was from, that so that elected members on behalf of the public could examine where all this money has gone, particularly in a time we're told where money's so short and when there's been cuts made to council services.
Thank you for that summary of the letter and the contents and the input and the context of it, John, because it does raise eyebrows, and it's certainly not normal practice for councils to do this kind of thing. So it'll be very interesting to see what the Auditor General's response is. The next thing I wanted to ask you was about the long-term transport plan. I understand the draft of the feedback from the public on this is with the local boards at the moment, and a lot of them are having special extraordinary meetings to actually handle the feedback and look at the implications of it and what they want to say about it to the Auckland Council. And that's 21 local boards doing this process. But I'm wondering if you have any comment to make on what you've seen of the draft feedback so far.
Yeah, one of the issues with some of the feedback and questions is that it can be very general and can be sort of self-evident. So, for instance, when you ask people, do you want improvements in public transport or more spend on public transport or more on roads? Generally, the question you're going to get is yes, because people, they see that naturally enough as being beneficial. So it's really the breakdown of how that feedback then translates into actual projects is really the key question, and that doesn't always necessarily emerge from, the documentation you get. But what has been clear in this one is that people, think that there should be a greater focus on providing, better public transport. And of course, that's in keeping with, emissions targets, but also the general trend that has emerged over the last decade, where Auckland Council has, through Auckland Transport, because it's Auckland Council who fund Auckland Transport, who've invested very heavily in our public transport. So no matter where you go around Auckland, north, south, east or west, there's been some massive big projects. So we've got the City Rail Link that's basically been built now, but is in a phase for the crucial phase of testing. So that's been, $5.5 billion there in the city. That's going to improve the whole rail network in terms of frequency of services. So for any communities around that serviced by rail, they're going to see quite a significant improvement in services. So is that one. There's big bus interchanges. There's one out at Manukau City. The Northern Busway has been extended up to Albany. The Northwestern has got quite an improvement in their bus network as a prelude to a full separated busway as well. And similarly, big new ferry terminal in the city for people that come in from any of the outer suburbs that are linked in by the ferry. Puanui, there's a big station interchange, and I could go on and on, but basically there's been a very big investment on public transport, and generally for a lot of people that's resulted in a lot more, better improvement in services. So I guess this particular plan is really, the feedback seemed to be people were wanting to see that continue and I guess to recover from the glitches of some of the disruptions through COVID and bus driver and ferry skipper shortages and some of the bad interruptions to the networks and the rail, but to see that recover and continue to grow. And I suppose, particularly for people that use public transport more, the better the service, the more it's going to encourage them to keep using it and also to get new sort of patrons in. So that was one area, Emery, that people definitely highlighted.
Yes, and one thing, as a regular user of public transport, one thing I've noticed recently is the number of bus drivers lowering the buses for older people. And we used to have to rev up campaigns to get them to do it. And I'm noticing that a lot of the new drivers just spontaneously, as soon as they see someone approaching that looks like they might be over 65, they're busy lowering the bus. And I am very impressed, and I actually give feedback to the drivers because I want to encourage them to keep doing it. But one of the things that has been in front of my eye has been anti-congestion charges and car parking charges. And for older people who have to go to medical treatment much more frequently than the rest of the population, it can be very difficult if you have to pay exorbitant parking charges or you have to pay an anti-congestion charge to get to the hospital. And if you're getting cancer treatment, you will be having it at Auckland Hospital, even if you're normally a patient at North Shore. So this will necessitate, depending on where the cordon is, but this will necessitate extra spending. Now, some people go once a week for treatment for even up to 12 months. That could be a significant budget game changer for people. And so I'm really interested in the clash between policies here, the clash between Auckland Council's policy, where it's signed up to be an age-friendly city and it has an action plan that includes focusing on improving public transport, and Auckland Transport having its own set of policies that say, well, we don't want to specialise in looking after any special interests of any particular group in the population. So we're not going to do anything specially for older people or for anybody in particular. So we're not going to acknowledge these people's needs or, you know, end of story. However, that is also contradicted by some of their pricing, because they do have special prices for students and children, and of course there is the gold card subsidy after 3 o'clock, which the council continues to fund, and quite rightly so, because largely that is how people get to healthcare and get home again. It's largely how they do volunteering in a large number of organisations that depend on being able to gather people from right across the city to do the jobs that they need.
Yeah, I think you've raised a number of very good points there. In the first instance, as far as the gold card goes, so 12% of the passenger boardings with Auckland Transport are through the gold card, which is really good, and which equates with the percentage of people in Auckland who are over 65, a bit over 12%, I think, back in 2018 anyway. It would have gone up a little bit. But so that's really good. It means people are using that service and making the most of it, and that's another better use of our public transport. And certainly, seniors are making a really good positive contribution to that use. And you mentioned the Age Friendly Action Plan. You're right. That's what the council and Auckland Transport have signed up to, and that has a number of transport initiatives that are designed to cater for total mobility users. I think AT brought in that new Plus One bus scheme, they, on the face of it, they were quite eager to continue advocating for that funding. So that's a real positive, and that's the way it should be, because that's just following any advanced city in the world where there's a awareness of age friendly, and particularly aiding people getting around their cities, getting around their regions with public transport and taking responsibility for that. But you're right, the congestion charge or the time of use charge, if you want to characterise it, which is just sort of starting to go through its planning stages, it does need to take into account groups such as the ones you mentioned, people having to go to services in hospitals through no fault of their own, and at times which may or may not be outside the peak charge or the off-peak charge or whatever. And I guess what ties into that is the quite stark disparity in New Zealand generally, but particularly in Auckland, between people on fixed incomes and maybe people who are almost the money no object crowd, of whom there are a number, and often it's the people who don't have too much experience of trying to get by on a fixed income that are making these sort of decisions. And $3, $5, whatever it might be, can be a significant charge to someone, particularly if it's duplicated a number of times, a week or in a given period. So that hasn't received too much light yet, Anne-Marie, but I would suggest that it's definitely a consideration that needs to be taken into account. Otherwise, you end up with a kind of essentially a regressive type of road tax where it hits disproportionately people on lower incomes, whether they're on pensions or whether they're just in occupations that aren't paid as much. And that would be entirely counterproductive. It would be hitting the people who can least afford it proportionately the most, and that's not going to be in anyone's benefit for that to happen.
Thank you for that comment, because I think we do need some fresh thinking about this. I mean, at the moment it's really focused on peak and off-peak, but I noticed in overseas jurisdictions where they have anti-congestion charges, they do allow for older people's needs, and they do it by giving people on a pension who need certain amount of access to certain services, they allow them something like a dozen free trips a year. And that's done by the number plate technology. So it's fairly straightforward. It's fairly easy to do. When it gets to something like cancer treatment and you're going every week for a whole year, then you need something equivalent to the total mobility card, that type of deal, but again, tied to the number plate technology. So there are probably going to have to be several different options in order to cater adequately for people in a sensible way.
Yes, and that's the very important detail that needs to be brought up. Otherwise, you have people making decisions who are unaware of the impact of the imposition of extra charges that will have on people in different circumstances. And I guess the one thing I would say too, Anne-Marie, is that the whole notion of congestion charging has been, since it started at Auckland Council, which was a number of years ago, has been predicated on the notion that there are alternative means available or options available to people, and that largely goes to public transport. Now, in a number of instances where hospitals are and times are, that doesn't even become that practical, even though it may exist, links to get you from, perhaps, the North Shore to Auckland Hospital, wherever it might be. But that's the proviso that was in there right from the start. So what we have to be very careful that it's not just, the Wild West here, where, costs are brought in, there's not much account taken of people's circumstances who will be unduly penalised by this, or alternatively, where they don't even have other options, that, where they live don't have regular public transport. And in a number of cases, if you look at Aucklanders too, they're completing multiple trips when they go out to any given place, that go across, that crisscross across the city too. So it's a little bit more complex than the adherents would have us believe, that it's just everyone going into the city and you can charge it, you know, that point, and that will capture everyone.
Thank you for that, John. We have to have you back again soon. Such a lot to cover. But thanks for being with us today, and we'll look forward to having listeners with us next week again. All right.
My pleasure, Anne-Marie. Thank you very much for the time to speak to people today. I appreciate it.